Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gentius from Kent State University, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, Dr. Kim Desmond of Indiana University of Pennsylvania interviews Dr. Mary Graham, an assistant professor of counseling at Seattle University. Their topic is Through the Eyes of a Child, Working with Children and Students in Poverty.
Hey, Dr. Graham, I want to thank you for talking with us today about working with children and students in poverty. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
I thought we could start first with a definition or description of the culture of poverty.
What I'd like to start with is telling you a little bit about the lens I see working with children in poverty. I actually come from a family of seven, and I'm the only sibling in my family to have graduated from high school, gone on to college, you know, and worked through getting a doctorate. Mm-hmm. Both my parents have eighth grade educations, and I think the most they ever made combined was $20,000 a year. And so their parents and grandparents came from similar backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And so today I thought I would talk to you a little bit about my lens and how I define working with children in poverty based on my own experience.
Great.
I think the first thing I'd like to start out with is talking about the idea of culture and poverty. And it sounds like in today's world we have a lot of lists that we create in working with people in poverty. Do this, or people in poverty are like this. And so I'd like to caution people about that and maybe talk about, instead of using the word culture of poverty, is I'd like to talk about understanding classism within our system and how we treat people that are living in poverty and how we work with children living in poverty, and maybe look at examining our own, as human professional, the service professionals, examining our own way of being with our clients of poverty.
Great.
And so in my life, being in poverty meant being without many things. It's growing up without proper food, clothing, access to services, medical, dental, just really scraping by to make it, and every day being a struggle.
Yeah.
And so to me, that's the definition I come with working with children and families in poverty.
So you're bringing kind of your experiences of being a family with seven children, and parents who were really having a lot of trouble making ends meet, it sounds like.
Yeah. A daily struggle. It was a daily struggle to get by, and it's really difficult. It's very difficult with large families making minimum wage in this country. So.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. How specifically do you see children affected by poverty? How does it affect the child?
I think it affects children in many ways, and I think I wonder if sometimes we just don't pay attention to children when working with our clients that are families in poverty. We sort of put the children on a back burner. Mm-hmm. But I think for me, working with children in poverty is recognizing that there's constant stress and uneasiness in the home. Every day, I think you feel like you're living on the edge of disaster, and that really impacts how a child feels in safety and security. Mm-hmm. At any moment, a financial crisis can come, a medical issue can come, and then the whole family is thrown into a spiral. And the children internalize a lot of the stress and uneasiness. I know as a child, being a child in poverty is coming home never knowing if there was going to be a crisis, if there was going to be food on the table, if there was going to be, you know, some medical issue, or if, you know, we would have to look at leaving or moving or living situation not being stable. And so I think just the uneasiness that children in poverty feel, that they're not going to walk home to milk and cookies every day. And also growing up in poverty brings a lot of shame. And I think children feel shame with being in that situation, not from anything their family has said or done to them, but things that they see on the outside,
mm-hmm.
Knowing that they don't maybe look the same as their classmates or dress the same or mm-hmm. maybe have clean clothes. And so that's a lot of children internalize a lot of that shame and embarrassment. And then facing judgments.
Mm-hmm.
I know that a lot of children face a lot of judgmental people. And oftentimes as adults, I wonder if we recognize how we treat children and how that affects them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking of a few instances when I was a school counselor working with in a high needs district.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers and students saying, teachers and faculty saying to the child, you know, why, where's your socks? Why is your coat dirty? Why aren't you dressed appropriately?
Mm-hmm.
You know, punishing the child for circumstances that they can't control.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, a children can't control if the laundry gets done or if there's socks to wear or if they're dressed appropriate for the weather. If the resources aren't there, you know, they can't control
mm-hmm.
that. But I think oftentimes we punish children for what they can't control that grow up in poverty.
And the assumption is made that the child does have access to clean socks and a clean coat or even a coat. The assumption is made that they have those things available to them.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And that's oftentimes not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're just trying to scrape by and get to school on time and to try to participate in education. And so they may not have access to those things. And so so just punishing them for things they don't have access or control over.
Mm-hmm. So what I hear you saying is it's kind of important for especially school staff in that example to take a step back from making that assumption that those resources are available. It's not kind of jump to that place immediately.
Right, not jumping to the conclusion that based on what an individual has, assuming that all individuals have that.
Great.
And I think oftentimes if counselors are coming from middle class to upper class uh-huh. situations or grew up in a way, they assume that, oh, well, everybody has this and that, and everybody has a pencil and desk and
mm-hmm.
computer, and that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. You started off answering this question by saying you think children are often placed on the back burner, that they're kind of overlooked because of the crisis. What are your thoughts on why that happens? Do you think it's just because the crisis is so immediate, or what do you think?
I think that the crisis is immediate with the adults, the
uh-huh.
family, helping them find services and food and shelter. And so
mm-hmm.
a lot of effort goes into working with the adults. And I just don't think in this country that we give a lot of credit to children
yeah.
in general.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like we just assume, oh, that they're a child. They're not going to be impacted. They'll follow suit with their parents. When, in fact, they're very impacted and shaping how they're going to view the world
mm-hmm.
and how they're going to grow up and look at society. And so I just think we don't give a lot of credit to children to begin with. So
yeah, great. What do you believe would be the most important information for human service professionals to know about working with families living in poverty?
I would think attitude,
mm-hmm.
the attitude that they bring to working with families and children in poverty, the way we treat children, as I spoke about earlier, punishing them for not having the resources that we may think they
mm-hmm.
need or should have. And just growing up in a family of poverty, it was clear to me that people found some level of disgust with our family, with my situation.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers, counselors, cash assistants, social workers, they were angry
mm-hmm.
with us because we didn't live a lifestyle that they thought we should live, or we didn't make appropriate choices based on what they thought we should be making choices on. And I knew everybody, everyone I dealt with, felt disgust for myself and my family growing up. That was clear.
Mm-hmm.
It was clear to me. The anger and the rage that we would sometimes face, that I remember as a child thinking that when working with some social service people, that they don't really like my parents, you
mm-hmm.
know, just the way they were talking down to them and condescending and being rageful towards them for doing the best they could. So I think the primary thing is the attitude that we bring to working with children
mm-hmm.
and families in poverty, the condescending, the judging, the punishing mm-hmm. the disgust that we come across with our faith, you know, that we show in our nonverbals and mm-hmm. even in our verbals, mm-hmm. to really be aware of that.
Mm-hmm. One thing you mentioned earlier is that frequently as human service professionals, sometimes we aren't even aware of our biases or some of the assumptions that we may be making about groups of people. Are there ways or things that we can do as professionals to become more aware and to kind of help us with that self-reflection process, do you think?
You know, I think that we do not give enough, trainings, exposure, working with people in poverty. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the largest growing group of people in poverty are 0 to 18 in this country.
Wow.
And we don't really spend a lot of time learning effective strategies, spending time getting to know mm-hmm. what we could do to make their lives easier. I think that so some additional training, but also developing relationships with people in poverty. You know, oftentimes as human services professionals, we're the people that have the power.
Uh-huh.
And
we
dole out to people what we think is appropriate based on our judgments. But we don't spend time getting to know people on a human level.
Mm-hmm.
We don't develop relationships. We don't work with people in poverty that are similar to us. We have a hierarchy of power.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say, if possible, actually getting out into your community and making relationships with people, equal relationships. People in poverty aren't people to be feared.
Mm-hmm.
They're not people that are going to hurt you. They're people.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of trying to decide their fate, maybe listening to them and developing relationships, spending time in the community.
Great. Maybe you've touched on this, and I don't know if there's something that you want to add, but what are some of the judgments you hear from human service professionals about families in poverty, and how do we work to combat these stereotypes?
Well, there's many. There
mm-hmm,
are many.
Sure.
And that I've heard. One thing that's personal, too, that I've heard is that, both my parents smoked.
Mm-hmm.
They smoked. They were addicted to nicotine cigarettes. And so just people, the way people treated, my family members, if people have enough money to buy cigarettes, then I don't understand why they don't have enough money to buy their children socks or mm-hmm. they don't have enough money to buy them a coat or a backpack. And so just recognizing that nicotine addiction is powerful
mm-hmm, absolutely.
To begin with. And so to judge somebody who has an addiction that's been facilitated over the years, it's just it's totally inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And also things like, I've heard lots of judgments about material things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they do have a big screen TV, or they have, look at the car they drive, and look at they have cable, and
mm-hmm.
if they just sacrificed all those things, then their life would be better. And I guess just to be cautious about a few things is judging people based on what we want ourselves
mm-hmm.
in middle to upper class. I mean, I would ask anybody in any circumstance, is it not okay to want to have things that we measure as successful in this country?
Mm-hmm.
We measure success as having material things. Yet we expect our children and family in poverty to sit in a vacated home and not have television, not have a cell phone, not have clothes to wear. And when they try to obtain those things, then we punish them
mm-hmm.
and we judge them.
So it's a no-win situation, really.
It's a no-win situation.
Yeah.
And so who doesn't want to have some amenities?
Mm-hmm.
Except we expect children and families in poverty to have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And if they get something, we also expect them to be grateful.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're not grateful, based on what we measure gratitude, we judge them, we punish them, we show them anger and disgust.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I keep hearing you say over and over again, and you actually started the conversation by saying this, I asked you to talk about the culture of poverty, and you said, look, before I do that, I really want to make the audience aware of the lens that I am using to view poverty and to describe poverty. And it seems like that would be something extremely important for anybody working in human services to be very mindful of.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
All of us bring our own lenses based on our lived experiences
mm-hmm.
into our jobs as counselors and human service professionals. And so it's so contradictory when we don't recognize or honor somebody else's lens that are different from mm-hmm. ours. And so it's just interesting that mm-hmm. sometimes the people that are most critical, most angry with the children and families in poverty are those that work in the human services field.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. And the irony in that, that's not really congruent.
It's definitely not congruent.
Mm-hmm. What do you think are some of the strategies for helping children living in poverty?
I think the primary thing would be unconditional acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
We have conditional acceptance of people in poverty. As human service workers, counselors, we decide that they should be doing this, they should be living this way, they should be trying to do better this way. And we don't really bring that unconditional positive regard that we're taught mm-hmm. in our field. We don't bring that to working with people in poverty. We bring that as long as they're doing what we tell them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the primary thing would be just unconditionally accepting children. And not punishing them or being angry for things that they have no control over.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's been circumstances where, we've given things out as a system, school system, or counselors, and then we expect this gratitude of mm-hmm. their children. And then when they don't say thank you or don't use manners that we identify as good manners, then we get angry with
mm-hmm.
them. And so to remember that... that if you're giving somebody something to help them, then there shouldn't be any of those additional strings attached, and then to be able just to give willingly.
Mm-hmm.
I would also say expectations. I would say that myself growing up in the school system specifically, mm-hmm. I had no expectations, none, on me. The teachers had no expectations of me. Other students didn't, because it was clear the kind of background I came from.
Oh, okay.
And I was able to sit through and pretty much fail high school without anybody trying to do any intervention. And I just challenge our system that, you know, children in poverty, they're bright, uh-huh. you know, just like any other child, and to have high expectations for them academically, and to assist them with their challenges if they have academic challenges, and to foster their development in education. And to really pay attention that they may not come with the skills we identify, but they can learn those skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they may not come with a large vocabulary, but they can certainly be taught vocabulary. Oftentimes we sort them out.
Mm-hmm.
We act as sorting systems. Those kids are not going to go on educationally, or those kids look at their family situations. So we decide as a system what their fate's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that oftentimes happens with elementary students.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
So we need to be really, we need to recognize that we do that as a system.
Mm-hmm.
Also strategies, many children in poverty and families in poverty lack medical and dental
mm-hmm.
care. And how can we as a system help? How can we approach that? How can we partner with medical and dental facilities to help our students get the services they need? And to recognize that not oftentimes do medical or dental providers take medical coupons or cash assistance, that you have to travel.
Mm-hmm.
You have to travel sometimes hours to find somebody that will work with you, and to change the system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how can we bring those services to our students in poverty and children in poverty? How can we bring that to their setting
mm-hmm.
To make it more accessible?
Mm-hmm.
I would say making services accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are just a few. And opportunities, providing all the opportunities that you would provide any child to mm-hmm. children in poverty.
Mm-hmm. This is fascinating to talk about, especially when we're thinking about students in the school system who are not held to the same expectations as other children who might have more opportunities. And do you have thoughts on kind of how that's developed over the years, why that's happened?
I would think one, now this isn't all true.
Sure.
By uh-huh. any means, but, and I just want to point out, I'm not generalizing, I'm just going to make a couple of statements about how I think it happened.
Mm-hmm.
One thing is, I think that oftentimes, like other human service providers, teachers, counselors might not have come from a background of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And so they enter the school system, and they believe that all children, you know, have the access and resources that they did as a child. So
mm-hmm.
they bring that in. They bring their lived experiences into their position as teachers and counselors, and are not willing to look through a lens of a child that might not have had that. And so I think that primarily that's a reason. Secondary, I think that if, you know, the children I worked with in poverty, and myself included, I was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't trust anyone. Mm-hmm. And so I had a tendency to be very assertive mm-hmm. in school with my teachers and my counselor. I didn't feel welcomed. And so I didn't feel like I wanted to engage in a system that didn't like me.
Sure.
And so I think that still happens today. I think it's really clear in our system, in our school system, that kids are treated differently based on their economic status, and I mean in a welcoming, warm way.
Mm-hmm.
And so to make sure that we are treating all students warmly and mm-hmm. kindly, and that we have patience,
mm-hmm.
Because if I I'd never heard of college before, for example, until I got into late high school. And so to understand that if children aren't exposed to certain things,
mm-hmm.
to show patience and reinforcement and continually to talk to them about different things and to show them opportunity and equality
mm-hmm.
from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that doesn't happen. I think it's more effort
mm-hmm.
to do that in a system, and I think that sometimes we might take the easy way out.
Okay. If it's okay, I'm going to ask you a little bit about your personal experience and being raised in a family of seven and being able to overcome some obstacles, go on to earn your PhD. I know you're now a counselor educator at Seattle University. And I think our audience might be wondering, wow, you know, how was she kind of able to begin to think differently about what kinds of goals she wanted for her life? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I actually didn't really have any goals in my life mm-hmm. until late high school. My parents both worked in the farm labor type.
Mm-hmm.
When we moved around a lot, and we finally settled in the Eastern Washington town, and they picked fruit, apples, field stuff, and loved me unconditionally.
Mm-hmm.
But never discussed with me ideas of college or post-secondary education. I mean, that just wasn't in my world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went about my business at school and struggled academically, and no one took the time to inquire why that was.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I ever had a teacher call home or inquire about my situation until I was later, you know, late in high school. And by mm-hmm. then I'd blown up most of my courses
mm-hmm.
and felt really sort of lost and angry. And my school counselor brought me in to speak to me about my plans. I always sort of joke with people and say, I think you have to talk to your student once before
mm-hmm.
they get out of
right.
high school.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't very interested in me other
yeah.
than that. And he asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, well, I said, I don't know. And he said, well, Mary, people like you do really good in the Army.
Mm.
And basically, he was saying that, you know, poor, trash, get into the Army, get out of my hair. Well, that's how I perceived it, whether
mm-hmm.
that's what his intention was
sure.
or not. So I proceeded to join the military, you know, get in the loop of joining the military. And there was one teacher who was a Future Farmers of America teacher, and
mm-hmm.
he had sort of took interest in all the misfits in the school. He was very... kind always to me. He had made efforts out in the community anytime he saw my parents to speak to them, showed them respect. And so he heard of this when I was a junior in high school, and he brought me in and he said, I don't think that's wise
mm-hmm.
for you to do that. I think you can be more. I think you can go to college. Well, I had never even heard of college. I mean, I've heard of college, but I didn't understand what that meant,
sure.
the application process. My grades were terrible. And so through mentorship through him, he helped me fill out my college application, and he helped my parents fill out the financial aid form.
Mm-hmm.
Then I sent away, and of course I didn't get accepted because I had, you know, a 1 point grade point average.
Uh-huh.
But the college had contacted me and said that we will accept you into the special program. It's a TRIO program, Student
mm-hmm.
Support Services for First-Generation Low-Income Students. But you'll need to come to campus and interview. Well, in my family, any kind of barrier that came up for us, we just stopped. Mm-hmm. We just stopped it. That was it. We moved around it. We didn't try to go over it. We were just done. You know, we just couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said to him, I can't go to college because I can't get up. I can't drive 2 hours to this college campus. Mm-hmm. And so he loaded me up with some other students and he drove me there and I had my interview and they accepted me. And mm-hmm. so I was in student support services and then just through, you know, different mentorships and experiences I've had with people in my life, I just went on to get a master's degree in school counseling
mm-hmm.
and went on to get a PhD. And
mm-hmm.
here I am.
Wow.
So.
What a story and what an inspiration that teacher, it was to you, obviously, but just hearing the story, I mean, it's just, that's really remarkable to hear the qualities that he had and believing in people and being out in the community.
The qualities I think we should all have as human service providers,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I mean, I was not easy to work with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm summarizing my story, but I was foul at times mm-hmm. as a teenager and angry, and he persisted and he was patient and he was kind.
Mm-hmm.
And through that persistence and believing in me, mm-hmm. I mean, it paid off. So.
Absolutely. And so because of that, you saw opportunities that maybe you hadn't seen before. Well, it sounds like you didn't see before.
It was a new world. You know, I went on to college, and the myth out there is people in poverty are ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
I went on to college. I never got, I mean, my grade point average soared through the roof,
mm-hmm.
close to 4 points at different times. And it opened up a whole new world. And so I wonder if I wouldn't have had that one moment, well, several moments with this teacher that mentored me, what would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And my parents, you know, would have loved me unconditionally no matter what I would have done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talking about your childhood, can you remember a time that you became aware that you were different or that you were part of this culture of poverty?
Yes, there are actually several times. I mm-hmm. remember one time being pulled out in the hallway. I was qualified for migrant services.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was pulled out in the hallway and lined up with all the other kids in the migrant service program and given TB tests. And I remember, like, people walking by and kind of scowling at us and, like, we were in the way, in the mm-hmm. hallway. And because in the migrant program, one of the things it used to be is you had to get TB tests, and then the nurse would come back and check and make sure
mm-hmm.
you didn't have TB. And very disenfranchising to line students up, poke them in the needle, and, like, throw
in the hallway, right? Horrible.
So that was just one time. And also I remember times with my family. We used to grocery shop very early in the morning. And I realized that we did that because we were, you know, food stamps.
Mm.
And less people, you know, were in the store early in the morning. And I just remember many times the clerks being just very mean and angry with my parents,
mm-hmm.
Yelling at them because they might have overspent and they're trying to fumble and just really treating us like we're nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was clear that, you know, we were different. And also just this, I also remember having shame and embarrassment of having, like, government cheese and anything, because lots of free food is marked FDA. You can tell it's food bank food.
Mm-hmm.
And so remember having that in my home and just thinking, I can't let anybody in my house. Nobody can see that I have these cans of, you know, government applesauce in the cupboard.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing mm-hmm. that was wrong,
mm-hmm.
knowing that was a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the whole scope, I know that wasn't. But as a child, feeling mortified and embarrassed.
Mm-hmm. And that maybe there's some shame associated with that.
Oh, definitely. Definitely mm-hmm. shame. Feeling shamed that my parents didn't come into school, and then also feeling shamed if they would have wanted to come into school.
Okay.
Just knowing how people looked at us.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. And so then given that situation, then school was avoided completely. You know, what we would think about as, like, parent-teacher conferences or things like that were avoided by your family or your parents?
Avoided all completely
mm-hmm.
Because they weren't, you know... You know, I'm saying they weren't. They felt they weren't welcome
mm-hmm.
there. And I recently asked my mom, I said, you know, Mom, why didn't you go to parent-teacher conferences? And she said she never had anything appropriate to wear.
Mm.
And so when you're walking into a system where no one said there's a dress code, but you know that people are going to judge you by what you bring in,
mm-hmm.
You know, she had one pair of shoes. And mm-hmm. so usually they were, you know, pretty mucked up because mm-hmm. of working. And so knowing that you were going to be looked at like that when you came in is not very, you know, welcoming.
Absolutely. But let's go back to our earlier discussion about stereotypes and generalizations. So as a school counselor, I could make the assumption that perhaps your mom is not interested in your schooling, is not interested in your education because she's not attending these parent-teacher conferences, when in fact that is not the case at all, that it was a completely different situation.
It was a completely different situation, but it was clear that the teachers and counselors felt that, you know, my family was uninvested mm-hmm. By the way. You know, you hear things as a student. You hear mm-hmm. them talking about you. You know, I remember a teacher saying she's not going to amount to anything. Mm-hmm. And so these are things that I wonder if we, as professionals, do we understand that our kids can hear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that when we say things around them, that they know that that's happening and that's mm-hmm. about them. And so, you know, my parents were completely invested, and they just did not understand the system.
Mm-hmm.
They did not understand that they could advocate for me to get better classes. Mm-hmm. They did not understand that they could come in and, you know, say, I don't like what's happening in this system. I mm-hmm. want to change. They didn't understand that they had a role mm-hmm. in education. From where they came from, they believe that whatever the school said or did was the authority.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we sort of grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
And based on the fact that they didn't have formal education, then the value that was placed on formal education was less than. Not because they didn't appreciate it, but because they didn't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
It's very well said. I mean, I'm just really struck by that comment that it's not really about not placing value on something. It's just the inability to kind of really understand the system. Do you think, from your perspective, are there ways to help children and to help families understand the system better? I mean, are there things as human service professionals we can do to help that? I think we can change the system, but are there ways we can also work within the system to get that change going?
I think one of the keys would be to work in to work out in the community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do so much in our schools and in that foreign office, mm-hmm. but I wonder why don't we go into the community and work with people in the community in the comfortable settings that they may feel in their home. I know that I've been on home visits before with different people that I've worked with, and
mm-hmm.
we've gone into students' homes that are in poverty. Immediately, I've seen my colleagues stiffen.
Mm-hmm.
People understand that you don't want to be in their home, and you think their home is quote unquote dirty or not adequate.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think the way we're portraying how we feel about our clients is huge. And so, I would say, you know, develop relationships, work with them in their homes, the churches, the community centers. Not to be afraid to be a part of their community.
Okay.
I don't think we do a job of, like I talked about earlier, develop relationships. We're all of the same community, no matter economic status, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so to spend time and actually getting to know people. I think mm-hmm. the thing that really helped with my teacher and my example was he spent time getting to know my parents on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
When he saw them out in the community, he specifically addressed them. And hi, Sylvia, hi, Bill. It's a joy to have your daughter in class, which I really don't think it was. But, you know, really spent time, never called them and said, you know, your daughter's terrible, what's she doing? Just really spent time to get to know them and show them respect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we don't do that enough. I think if we treated people with respect and on an equal level, then I think the others would naturally follow.
Mm-hmm. So in my head, I'm picturing this teacher kind of seeking out your parents or seeking out other families that intentionally. I mean, I guess I'm thinking he was very intentional in wanting to do that. Would you agree with that?
Oh, very intentional. He, in fact, went. My mom worked in a packing shed where she sorted apples and packed the fruit. And because he was a vocational ed teacher, I think he had the opportunity to go out into the field.
Uh-huh.
And so he would go out into the sheds and he would talk to moms and parents and, you know, spend time with them.
Mm-hmm.
And very intentional about getting to know people and family and getting to know us as people and not just as students. And
mm-hmm.
so very not, unique person.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything else you would like to share that you think it would be important for us to know?
I would just challenge us as a system to examine our views and classist issues, mm-hmm. and not think about, okay, I know there's a lot out there about lists and people in poverty do this and people in poverty do that and people in poverty act this way. And nobody told me I was a part of a culture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one came, hey, wow, did you know you're in the culture of poverty?
Yeah.
I didn't have any knowledge of that.
When did you get that knowledge?
When I got to school and people said, oh, there's a culture of poverty when I got to college. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, there is?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. So did I miss some special membership initiation?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we oftentimes want the quick fix and the easy answer. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there is a quick fix and an easy answer to poverty in the United States. I think that what I suggest is examining our own classes' views as human service professionals,
mm-hmm.
how we treat people. Do we feel anger and disgust with our clients? What do we bring to the table? What are our lenses that are providing barriers? Because I think it's our issue, our barriers that we bring to the table with our clients in poverty, not theirs. And so I think if we spent a lot more time talking about the culture of classism and how that impacts our work with children and families, I think we'd be better off than talking about how do we work in the culture of poverty.
Mm, fantastic. Anything else?
No, I just I hope that we can move forward and work with children in poverty and largest growing group of people in poverty are 0 to 18 years,
mm-hmm.
And you're powerless when you're 0 to 18 years. You don't have a lot of power in your life,
mm-hmm.
and when we show oppression based on class, we're taking more power away from our children, and
mm-hmm.
so just. We need to do a better job of listening and valuing and understanding how we as human service professionals, how our behavior impacts the children we work with.
Mm-hmm. I know, Dr. Graham, that part of also what you do is that you go into school districts and community agency settings to do workshops. And I think the title is something from government cheese to PhDs. Is that...
Yeah,
is that what it is?
That's my title, from government cheese to PhDs, working with children and families in poverty.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
I really have a passion for getting out there and working with school districts and agencies and just helping them look at the situation in a different lens.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm always interested in going into agencies and schools to work with the faculty and staff to help better serve
Great.
Children and families in poverty.
And if people are interested in getting more information from you, can they contact you through Seattle University and your email account there?
Absolutely. Fall of 2008, my email account and information will be active
Great.
Seattle University. And so I
Excellent.
Welcome inquiries and comments.
Great. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You've just heard an interview of Dr. Mary Graham of Seattle University regarding working with children and students in poverty.
Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselaraudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4242. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.